So we still are in chapter 7, are we not? I think we actually included verse 1 of chapter 8, and I know we didn't get to that. Have we done 14 adequately, or do you feel that we need to do 14 through 16? Or wait a minute, 14 through 15.
We did talk quite a bit about washing the robes.
Yeah.
And before the throne and spreading the tent. But right. We didn't. Yeah, I don't think we talked about 16 and 17.
Okay, so why don't we start with 16, Bill, and read through chapter 8, verse 1.
Revelation 7, 17, 8, 16, 17, and 8, 1, Free Bible Version. They will never be hungry ever again or thirsty. The sun will not beat down on them, and they will not suffer scorching heat, because the Lamb, who is at the center of the throne, will be their shepherd and will lead them to springs of living water. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Verse 1 of chapter 8. When he opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for around a half hour.
No sun or scorching heat will beat down on them. That's going to be revisited in the plagues.
Yeah.
So is this sort of a foreshadowing of that?
It is a kind of a, not just a foreshadowing, but a preparation for that. Because what it does is say, you know, if you stay with Jesus and you follow the Lamb wherever he goes, those plagues aren't going to get you. See, he's going to shelter you.
Well, that just opens up a lot of questions in my mind. Like, we banter around the words probation and probation closing, and when do things happen? And or is this more about post Earth age and going into the future?
I'm not trying to do a chronological review of it.
Okay.
I'm doing more of a thematic and how it flows review. And to me, this prepares the reader
for the next iteration.
Right, for the plates.
Okay.
I keep having to remind myself as I'm going through Revelation, for me, the criteria I use to interpret every single verse is that I first look at it as symbolic. So if I look at this and it says they'll never be hungry or thirsty, and I jump to the literal, that opens a whole path of scenarios. But if I look at it and say, well, what kind of hunger? And what would the Bible talk about hunger? What kind of thirst? Immediately, especially in the next verse, springs of water, I go right to the woman at the well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
And the sun beat on them. Well, that shows up in the plagues. So if I look at these as symbols, and even the plagues, you know, they might be literal. I'm not denying that. But even those, I say, how could all of these things be symbolic of, and then secondarily, they might be literal?
I'm going to give you a spoiler alert. The sun and the plagues, which is one of the first plagues. It's like the third plague, I think. These plagues fall in Babylon, right? In Babylon, the sun was the god of justice. Retributive justice.
Oh, wow. That opens up a whole venue.
Well, there's a reason why I studied the ancient Near East. Yeah. I had tremendous questions about Revelation and Babylon and Revelation.
That also resonates with what I see in the sixth trumpet. So
I will say that I deeply appreciate the reframing to being hungering and thirsting for righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Like the Sermon on the Mount.
Sermon on the Mount. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like that too.
It makes.
And I think the clue that that's where we're going is the final line. He will lead them to springs of life-giving water.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That isn't about being physically thirsty. That could be a part of the problem, but mm-hmm. it's about receiving the water of life. And again, the woman, the Samaritan woman. So both Sermon on the Mount and the Samaritan woman I think, can figure in here.
And then Jesus in the temple, you know, crying out, if anybody is thirsty, let him come to me.
Yes.
And drink. He's clearly not talking about physical
water. No. Well, why would everything above that be symbolic and not the last few lines?
Right.
It's true. But I have heard it where, you know, we take one section and apply it to another section without reflecting on the context of a sentence mm-hmm. or two or a verse or two. So I think that's where mine ends up coming from, is this deep practiced recitation and implied protection from physical calamity as opposed to spiritual calamity. And that's, I guess I love the reminder of the revelation of God is genuine, real, and physical, but it's also spiritual. And here we're seeing the contrast of the spiritual versus the rebellious, spiritually rebellious.
You know, what's interesting in these three verses, 15 to 17, three different orientations to the throne are mentioned. I don't know if that depends on translation or not, but there's before the throne, there's on the throne, and then there's in the midst of the throne.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty concentrated.
The one who sits on the throne will shelter them, and the one who is in the midst of the throne will shepherd them. And
is it the same one?
Before the throne.
Is the one who sits on the throne the same one as who is in the throne?
No.
Or the midst of the throne?
I think it's the Father.
Yeah.
I like to think that the Father is ultimately the one who saves us, even though Jesus provided the way to the Father who saves us.
Well, now, it's the people who are before the throne.
Right.
The Lamb, I have the Lamb who is at the center of the throne will be their shepherd. And it's entertaining to me that it's the Lamb who is the shepherd.
Yeah. Yeah, that definitely challenges metaphors, right? The lamb leads the rest of the sheep.
Yeah.
Well, unless you become as a little child, you can't become a shepherd. So flesh out that sun beating on them a little bit more. I'm really curious.
Well, let's not forget God wiping away every tear, because that's featured in Revelation 21:4. This is why you can't really read it chronologically in some ways and understand.
I think this is a summary, because this interlude is talking about two groups of people and it's right. describing their experience, but I think it's a very expansive. Yeah, it's taking it all the way to the end.
Yeah, it could be. There are, you can take a number of places like that. All the way to the end. But anyway, so what do you want to know about?
Well, justice? I can make a whole lot of speculations, but I'd like to get it from the horse's mouth. You know, what does, and also it says, neither will the sun beat on them nor any heat. So it's making a distinction between the sun and the heat. What's the difference?
You know, the God of justice was not known as a sun, the sun who heats, but the sun who lights and exposes evil. That's how the sun worked in terms of ancient Babylonia. So I'm not sure what to do with the heat.
Well, you're onto something there, it seems like.
I think it's featured in the plagues. The fourth angel poured his bowls, verse 8, chapter 16, on the sun, was allowed to burn people with fire. The people were burned by intense heat.
So the words in the King James, it says light. I'm just looking at Strong's, since that's all I have. And the Strong says the sun light on them, which is clearly a different word than the heat. And the light, well, now I'm curious. I want to see where it comes from. Means to fall on or fall down on.
Are you still in chapter 7?
Yeah, verse 16.
Okay.
Neither shall the sun light, my version said beat, and is pipto, which it says is to fall down on them.
Dipsay susin.
I'm in Isaiah 49, by the way.
Yeah, that's probably quite relevant.
Yes, this is found in Isaiah. So 7:16. Dipsao is to thirst. Kama is heat.
Yeah. And in Isaiah 49, it distinguishes between the two, too.
Well, I find the whole section, 49:8 and onward, the Lord, this is what the Lord says, I will answer you at the proper time. I will help you on the day of salvation. I will take care of you, and I will give you to the people as my agreement with them, to restore the land and to reassign the parts that have been abandoned. Tell the prisoners, come out. Tell those living in darkness, come into the light. And like sheep, they will feed along the roads and in the pastures on the hills that were once barren. They won't be hungry or thirsty, and they won't get hot in the sun. For the one who loves them will lead them to the springs and guide them to the water.
Mine on verse 10 said, they will not hunger or thirst, neither shall the heat nor the sun smite them. For he that has mercy on them shall lead them even by the springs of water. So really, this is a condensation of the passage in Isaiah quite clearly.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly a callback, I would think.
Right.
But it distinguishes between the two there, too, as well.
Mm-hmm.
And when you said light rather than heat, it seemed like maybe that is the difference. It's distinguishing between the light and the heat as two different things. Because, I mean, we have cool lights, right? You can have a brilliant light but not feel any heat.
Yeah, I mean, in the Isaiah section, it's still that call to come out of Babylon. You know, to the prisoners, come into the light, be free.
You're That's not, why it has it.
Yeah.
That's why he's using it. It's a call to come out of Babylon.
I was thinking of the same aspects in Zechariah 14, in which we have quite a few of those terms mentioned regarding light, water, plagues, and that sort of thing. I just thought I'd bring that up. I don't know if that is even relevant. So I just
Did you say Zechariah 13?
14. Yeah. And I don't know. I was reading that recently, and it kind of jumped out at me because of the horror of the consumption and whatnot. But yeah, so I don't know. I just thought I'd bring that up if there was any relevance to it. I don't know.
It says, on that day there will be no light. This is verse 6. Splendid things will disappear. On one day known to the Lord, there will be neither day nor night, but at evening there will be light.
And living waters will go out from Jerusalem.
Yeah. There could be some, I'm trying to think of the literary term when you, my mind's blank on it. When you take something, an allusion, it could be an allusion to that verse. Well, I don't want to explore too much about the plague part of that until we get there.
Right. But the light, go back to the symbolism of Babylon and the sun beating down. What did that mean to them?
It meant the light after the night. You see, the moon was the god of justice at night because it shone and it revealed the deeds of evil done in the night. The sun was the justice during the day because it revealed the deeds that were evil done in the night. That's one aspect of it. The sun had also divinatory qualities because divination was a form of justice. And they would take the idea of how they did things on earth and plant them into the way how the gods did them up there. And so the real god of justice was Ea, or Enki, who was the god of fresh water. But the actual omens that they used were verdicts. So the gods were judging the people in verdicts. And when anybody asked a Baru priest, omen priest, to please do an omen reading for him, they would bring an offering. This would be the way the Babylonians did sacrifices, by the way. They sacrificed the animal, and they took the liver and the entrails, and they would determine the verdict according to the omens that had been written before.
So are you saying that they would read the entrails and whatnot, almost like tea leaves kind of thing?
They read them like cuneiform signs. In fact, there's a statement made by the Babylonians that the universe, or I guess the earth was like a great clay tablet with cuneiform signs that the gods could read.
Or write.
Well, the Baru priest would pray that the gods would write accurately in the entrails of the sheep or the lamb the omen for that particular person. Most often that particular person was a king. But it was all about justice, and you're dealing with verdicts, so you're dealing with the court setting, you're dealing with...
But there's certainly no cause and effect going on there.
No.
Yeah.
Why would there be in Babylon?
The whole thing is arbitrary. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. All of Babylonia is arbitrary.
Yeah.
So let me, I guess, the idea of the verdicts, and then what are we thinking when the books are opened and the judgment of God?
Opening a can of worms here, are you?
Well, is this the time? I mean, it's yes. Later on, but
yes.
I don't mind going over things twice because we learn better that way.
Yeah. Okay.
Than just doing it once.
Well, because
should I get my helmet on, or where are we headed?
We're caving. hopefully not in. But when I hear verdicts, it brings to mind that I might be on trial and the books of my behavior are, you know, books are opened and every deed done is somehow evaluated, and that there's a verdict that I am a sheep or a goat and I go to the left or to the right. Now, there may be a form, there may be a function, and there may be a complete misunderstanding of things. So when I hear Babylonia was based in verdict and it was arbitrary, then I'm wondering how we use language to describe what's going on in the courts of heaven, which I don't see as legal courts, but I see as a gathering of representatives from around the universe.
You know, that's an interesting question. So if we go to Job, you have a court scene. You always court. Satan comes among them, and he puts Job, or God puts Job on trial by simply saying, "Have you considered my servant Job?"
Because he's countering Satan's claim.
Countering Satan's claims, but it ends up because Satan grabs it and says, huh, have you, etc., have you tested him?
He's pushing back.
So God says you may do to him as you will, but guard his life. The Hebrew is actually guard his life. And so Satan goes out and he takes everything Job has, including his children. And Job says, Yahweh gave, Yahweh took away, blessed be the name of Yahweh. And so Job, so Satan comes back to God. And God says, have you considered my servant Job? That there is no one like him on the earth. And even though you incited me against him without a cause, that word is kinam, without a cause, he still preserves his uprightness. He still worships me.
So this is an indictment against Satan now.
Well, what do we have in Revelation 12? He's the accuser of the brethren who accuses them day and night before
God. That's right. So Satan is exposing himself because God says you can do whatever you want to him, but he didn't tell him to do bad things to him. So out of Satan's heart comes all this evil. And then God says, well, I got blamed for everything you did, but you didn't even, you were supposedly executing justice, but against an innocent person. Therefore, you are the criminal by implication, which is true.
And I would still say, I struggle. I can appreciate the idea that by God saying, have you considered my servant Job? Job becomes sort of quotes on trial, but again, only in the mind of the adversary, but not in the mind of God.
Right.
Yeah. Well, the thing to remember, I want to back up here, if you don't mind. I just found out something in my version that I never saw before.
Okay.
The Lord said to the adversary, look, all that he has is within your power. Literally hand, but hand means power. Only don't stretch out your hand against him.
Mm.
That's what my version says. And I'm trying to figure out where they got that because I can grab my Hebrew Bible here. I don't remember being able to translate it that way.
What chapter?
That's chapter 1,
okay.
Verse 12. As of last May, I'm 20 years from getting my doctorate. It's getting a little fuzzy here, what I did on my dissertation. Verse 12.
You know, hungry, thirsty, the sun beating on them, the heat. That sort of applies to Job, doesn't it?
Yeah, it kind of does, doesn't it?
So the Septuagint, which I'm looking at, said, he said to Satan, see, I give into your hand all that he has, but do not touch him.
That's kind of how I've translated it from Hebrew. Let's see if I can find. I get so disoriented having to switch from right to left when I get in the Hebrew Bible. When I'm thinking about a bunch of things at once. Okay, here we go. And God said to Satan, behold, all that belongs to him, all that he has, is in your hand. Only to him you shall not stretch out your hand. So you would have to translate that against him. So the actual Common English Bible is right.
But doesn't that make a distinction between what he has and him as a person?
Yes. Yes, that's the distinction.
So attack everything he had, but he couldn't attack him as a person.
You can attack him. But
until the next round.
So the next round, he's allowed to touch Job, but he has to guard his life. That's when the guard his life comes.
Right. That sounds like waterboarding.
Well, it certainly would have been torture.
Yeah.
I mean, the first round was already torture.
Moves from psychological torture to physical torture.
And so what it seems to me then in Revelation is that God does not give in to the adversary any longer. You cannot, you know.
He's setting boundaries. And this is how I see the great controversy going. That Satan isn't allowed to do just anything he wants.
Right.
God is the gatekeeper. And he puts boundaries around him. If he violates those boundaries, God can intervene with a miracle. That's how I see it working.
And he has to give the adversary room to expose himself, which I think I appreciate here is if he's giving everything Job has into the adversary's power or hand, he doesn't have to do anything nefarious with
that's right.
Except that that is his intent because that's who he is.
So he has revealed his real character.
Yes, yes.
As one who wants to hurt Job emotionally, psychologically, any way he can.
And that's
and in some ways he hurt him physically because taking your children in an ancient Near Eastern culture where that is your eternal life, that those are your descendants. That is akin to physical torture.
Right. Well, and that's kind of what I'm thinking in Revelation 7, is that what we get are a spiritual protection against the adversary and the receiving of the spiritual blessing of God. So, the uninterrupted flow of the gifts.
So I would like back to your records.
Oh, we didn't thank
resolve.
You. That's where it did start, the verdict, yes.
I'm thinking of something. I'm tempted. Go ahead and discuss what you want on that.
Well, I saw another phrase we haven't tapped in 16 anymore, which strongly implies it's been going on. They will be thirsty anymore, which means they have been thirsty. They have been hungry. The sun has been beating on them. The heat has been affecting them. But now it says it's not going to happen anymore. So there is a timestamp here somewhere.
I didn't get the anymore in my version.
Okay. Mine says they will never be hungry, neither thirsty anymore.
Hmm. I think that is inferred in the Free Bible version.
It is in King James as well. Anymore. New Revised Standard, they will thirst no more.
I think that is inferred because these are those who have washed their robes white in the blood. And so they have suffered, and so no more will they suffer. Yes.
Yeah, in the Greek has a word for that, which is eti, yet, or after that, hereafter. So it is a timestamp, it looks like. I mean, a point in time. It's a transition point. I wonder, besides the seeming strangeness of lamb shepherding, I wonder what it means for him to shepherd these people, because clearly that's not physical. So what does it mean?
There's so much of that to me is a spiritual.
It's a spiritual. It's like the pastor was the shepherd of the people, of the congregation in the New Testament.
Is that more like leading them?
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to experience everything they're going to experience.
Right. You've heard the story of the American businessman who was traveling in the Middle East, and he saw a man driving his sheep ahead of him with a staff. He was beating them and driving them. And he pulled off the road. The businessman pulled off the road. And he ran over to the man and he said, "Stop treating your sheep like that. That's terrible. You're abusing them. You shouldn't be a shepherd if you're going to treat them like that." And the man said, you have to understand, I'm not their shepherd. I'm taking them to the slaughterhouse. So in ancient Near Eastern culture and Middle Eastern culture to this day, the shepherd always went ahead of the flock. And the flock followed him because he called them by name. So I think that's what the kind of shepherd Jesus is. That's how we follow him. He calls us by name.
We know his voice.
We know his voice. Yeah.
Okay. So then I come back to verdict. And then in the Babylonian understanding, and I'm looking at Revelation 20, and this is post 1,000 years. So I think, is that the only place the books are opened officially in the record?
I think so.
You know, because it seems to me that there's a level of evaluation of God in the millennium. And we're judging God's behavior or actions through a millennium of why are people there who shouldn't be there in our minds, mm-hmm. and why are people who should be there not there in our minds. And so we're questioning the rightness of God. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, that's again my inference of the millennium. Then we have post-millennium, Revelation 20, verse 11, 12. I saw the dead, great, small, standing before the throne, and the books were opened. And another book, the book of life, was opened, and the dead were judged based on what was written in the books about what they'd done. And the sea handed its over dead, and Hades handed over its dead, and everyone was judged according to what they had done. And then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire, and the lake of fire is the second death. Anyone whose name is not found written in the book of life was thrown into the lake of fire. Well, this sounds like a verdict, or the verdict has written. So I'm just playing the...
That's a very Babylonian motif.
Okay.
Understand. This is in what, Daniel, that you were reading?
No, this is Revelation 20.
Revelation 20.
Oh, the Revelation 20, 21. Yeah, and again, I see all these Babylonian images in Revelation. According to what is written is our life.
Yes.
And is it going to be in a literal book?
I think our own brains are the book.
And that could be.
We are the book.
But it's open. Everything is stored.
So there's, so what I'm hearing you say is,
what it is an evaluation of the life. Does life demonstrate this person has been won back to love and trust God? It isn't weighing every deed against the feather of Ma'at on the scale of justice that you have in Egypt.
That's the counterfeit.
It isn't going by the omens and reading entrails in a sheep as in the Babylonian method. It is reading what really is.
The motives of the person themselves.
Right.
A revelation. Okay, there's a few things I'm hearing. One, God's government is transparent.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Based on that transparency, it sounds to me like he's not the gatekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, the transparent life for all who have an interest can see why they are or why they have refused God, mm-hmm. or why they and how they accepted
he
God.
He takes in all the circumstances of everyone's life. He knows that this man was born there, according to Psalms. It's an evaluation, and it's done by someone who wants desperately to save as many as he can. It is not done by someone who is a stern judge and just simply wanting to whack anybody he can.
So would it be fair in the whole of Scripture to say, while we may see this as God's verdict, I hear Psalm, I think 139, I don't know, he gives us our heart's desire.
Mm-hmm.
And so the verdict is the reality of one's heart's desire. Is that?
Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's a beautiful way to put it.
Yeah. Everybody gets what they want ultimately.
And that is opposite, not only in process, but in actuality, the language of verdict. It's in opposition to the way the Babylonians understood verdict.
Yeah.
And God's verdict is an honoring, transparent honoring of his creature's desire, deepest desire.
It's okay. Honoring our choices.
Okay. I always now apply to the word judgment in every case, unless it's blatantly different. I always insist on the absolute clear definition of judgment based on Jesus in John 3:19-21.
I will not. Yes. Why didn't we think of that?
That is the only valid definition of judgment, the way God does it, which the only part God has in judgment is to shine the light. And that's it. He does not make the verdicts. The next two verses clearly reveal our reaction is the verdict. It's not God's determination.
Yes.
Oh, so here's how the Free Bible Version says that, 3:19. This is how the decision is made. The light came into the world, but people loved the darkness rather than the light, for their actions were evil. All those who do evil hate the light and don't come into the light, because they don't want their actions to be exposed. But those who do good come into the light so that what God accomplishes in them can be revealed.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Which chapter is that?
That's John 3:19-20.
3:19, yeah. I was thinking it was John 3.
Yeah.
When we apply that definition of judgment to everywhere, especially in Revelation, it just completely changes everything. It's no longer an arbitrary decision. It's a reaction. It's exposing through the reaction that we have to the light. And there's only two classes of people. They either react negatively to being exposed, or the light actually heals them if they let it. And then their reaction is they love it. They synchronize with it.
That's the difference. Yeah. That's the difference between light in Babylonia and light in the Bible, in the Gospels. Light in Babylonia always meant judgment, justice.
Requiring punishment.
Yes.
Retributive.
Yeah. Right.
Retributive justice. It meant justice a kind of distributive justice for those who were being oppressed by the person that was getting retributive justice. But retributive justice seemed to be paramount. Whereas in the Bible, light means the truth. And it usually means the truth about God. So here's the summary of Jesus' teaching in the Gospel of John. Jesus shouted, "Whoever believes in me doesn't believe in me, but in the one who sent me. Whoever sees me sees the one who sent me. I have come as light into the world so that everyone who believes in me won't live in darkness. If people hear my words and don't keep them, I don't judge them. I didn't come to judge the world, but to save it. Whoever rejects me and doesn't receive my words will be judged in the last day by the word I have spoken. I don't speak on my own, but the Father who sent me commanded me regarding what I should speak and say. I know that his commandment is eternal life. Therefore, whatever I say is just as the Father has said to me." And once again, he uses the familiar terminology of command. The Father commanded me, so they would take it seriously.
That was rich, and I need to put a little note above my computer.
I don't know why that slipped my mind. It's just always been my go-to text.
Well, probably because
I think the books brought me back to childhood when I was 7 years old. It was my job to dust upstairs on Friday afternoon. And some teacher had read the story of Booker T. Washington, or else it was in Guide magazine, who was trying to get a job, and they sent him to dust and to clean a certain room. And he dusted like three or four times all the furniture. And so they hired him. And so somehow that got intertwined with what I was taught when I was 6 years old about the books being open and every deed done and God. And if we have one sin unconfessed in those books, you know,
that's the way
somehow didn't get the unconfessed part.
Oh, wow. That's heavy.
And so
what a burden.
I was like, I don't dare miss a corner of the dresser and dusting, or Jesus will meet me at the end of the millennium and say, you can't look at me very sternly and say, you can't go to heaven because it says here in the books on May 4, 1964, Jeannie missed the corner of the dresser while dusting.
You had the arm of the white glove upon you.
And I dusted and dusted and dusted. This one Friday afternoon, I was taking too long, carefully removing everything, dusting everything off. And my mother, who was always worried about the clock, yelled up the stairs, "Linda, Jean, Sheldon, whatever is taking you so long?" Of course, I knew I was in trouble. So she flew up the stairs before I could answer and grabbed dust rag out of my hand. By this time, I was in her and Dad's bedroom. And she began to just whisk it around the room, getting everything dusted really quickly and scolding me all the while about it's almost sundown and you haven't had your bath yet and blah, 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 blah. And I watched her because I have the observer temperament. So I watched her and she missed a corner of the nightstand. I said, Mommy, you missed the corner of the nightstand. She says, oh, don't worry about the corners. We don't have time to worry about that. And she started a recital again of what was wrong. And I thought, oh no, she's going to be lost. Maybe I should tell her. Then I thought, you know, if she doesn't know better, she's not guilty.
Her blood be upon you for not setting her straight.
So much for letting your light shine, huh? I was thinking when you said, Floyd, when you were talking about that, what jumped in my mind was, what if the books are kind of like you said you thought it was a record of our lives, like as played out. And it kind of jumped out to me, if it's transparent or whatever. I don't know. I just thought of an 8-track, you know, what if it's here, we show up with our 8-track and plug it in. Let's take a look at it, see what's going on. And if it's all darkness, well, there you go. There's a foregone conclusion. But if it's,
I think Floyd has a good point that it's the record is in our heads, they're in our minds.
Well, yeah, all
it's
right.
True. It's true.
Yeah, not a VHS. Let's look at it. Wherever you download, wherever you're storing anything, it's data, correct? And you know, maybe it's in the cloud, whether or not he comes with the rainbow or not. But I'm just wondering about that transparency, whether or not it's something that we reflect back in, kind of like what you were talking about, that judgment being upon somebody's own witness, if you will, you know, or how we react, I guess.
You know, I think there's a good technological analogy today. It's not everybody understands it, but I think enough people have heard about it. You know what an RFID chip is, right? And
I don't.
Okay. Well, I'll let Bill explain it because he probably could explain it better than I could. What is the RFID chip?
Is that what goes good with buttermilk?
No.
Sour cream?
Dutch ranch. No.
Is that what you put in? Is that the new techie 5D cookie formula that you came up with? Or
so there are chips and a number of things, but most recently, and most people would have it in contactless credit cards. So almost every credit card today
has a chip. It's the reader chip.
And you tap instead of inserting or sliding, you just tap. So you don't actually have to tap, but it gets it close enough. Anyway, the idea is the information necessary for the transaction is on the card and in the cloud. So both are communicating to make that a reality. And your card contains your information, the as it was. So anyway, you protect it. It's in a sleeve so that nobody can come along and just swipe it and clone it. That's at least how I keep mine. Otherwise, people can walk by with a reader and grab it.
But the point is, how is it read?
So, right. In order to make the transaction happen, the reader has access to a lot more information, your purchase history, any reported misuse or flagged use. And so if I've called to say my credit card was stolen, that'll be flagged. And the next time I go to use it or somebody were to use it, it would not work. If there was some strange transaction that was out of the pattern, it would flag. But there's a reader and there's my card. And the two have to be aligned
But my understanding is that the chip has no power.
Not really.
An RFID chip has information, but there's no power in the chip. Yeah, the only way the chip can be read is the power is supplied by the reader. And so the power goes to the chip. It sort of brings the chip alive and causes the chip to then transmit out back into the reader. Yeah. So the power comes from the reader, not from the chip.
If in that sense, then yes, the reader is life to the card. Into the chip.
Right. It provides the power to activate the information to then be returned back to the reader.
See, I have this belief that every action, everything, every event in history, every deed done by anything, animal or human, is stored on light rays.
Oh, I can accept the possibility of that. God is true light and energy.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that light would be the storage system and give light back. Mm-hmm. We can say, oh, I deny everything. And where am I? In darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And then the one who trusts God says, wow, I don't even recall some of that. I could have been pretty hideous, but my heart, my desire is to be with God. I mean, sincerely, genuinely, and now I'm walking in that light.
Yeah.
And I'm transparent to the universe. And I think that's a node of information, the heart's desire, trumps everything.
So is it possible that because we lost our robes of light, we are no longer transparent? And then that's a merciful thing. Because you think if we were walking around transparently, what other people would do with our transparency?
Yeah. Oh, that's why the great hereafter, it is safe to be that transparent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think there'll be people who've watched us, and now that we are transparent, can ask us what we were thinking some date in history, and we'll have the clarity. And through that conversation, look at God as being amazing. For how he brought it.
Because then we'll have the context, the far bigger context available to us that we didn't have when we had that thought originally.
Right. Where we might have carried guilt and shame, we can realize that it was pointless.
Yes. Well, if your heart condemns you, God is greater than your heart. If your heart doesn't condemn you, then you have boldness.
Yeah.
So you can imagine sitting down with Jesus under the tree of life, and he goes through your whole life to answer any questions you have about it. if there's transparency, you're not, you see, in the presence of someone who is love itself and who you know would never intentionally hurt you or unnecessarily in any way harm you.
Or shame you.
Or shame you.
Yeah, yeah, there's
no. You can afford to just, yeah, I did that. I wish I hadn't. And then Jesus explains what led you to do that. And there's such healing in that.
Well, that's how people are healed even today.
Yeah.
If people, I mean, that's what recovery groups do, is to be, start being honest in a safe environment where people care about you and the healing starts happening.
And of course, psychologists have this kind of meme, name it and tame it. If you can name what it is, you can tame it. And once we understand, there is so much healing. In fact, Jesus equates understanding with healing. In the parable of the sower, he makes a direct connection between understanding and healing. They would not understand and be healed, is what he says.
So, thinking about the heat and the sun burning, that we would be protected from that, it would not be difficult to say those who trust God can't be burned by their history.
And they're not afraid of the light.
Right. I mean, that goes back to
John. I thought of it. I like that, and I don't want to say you're wrong because I'd like to keep it.
Well, there may be.
I've thought of something different.
Okay.
And I don't know if this is working.
Multiple applications are certainly valid.
If you believe the light and you're in the light, you're not going to be burned by a misconception of God as an angry judge ready to condemn you.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah, well, that is true in the sense that God's Shekinah is life to those who trust and seems to be a consuming fire of death to those who have rejected life. I mean, that's my words of trying to.
And you wonder if the misconception they have of God doesn't play a major role in that destruction.
Yeah.
If they cling to that lie in the face of light. To the contrary.
Yeah.
Isn't that terribly destructive?
Yeah.
That's the torment that they experience in the presence of the Lamb and the angels, is the exposure and the dissonance that it causes to the point where you want to self-destruct to get away from the torment.
Yeah.
The very thing that was purposed for peace and harmony is experienced by adversarial thinking, completely different. That's amazing to me. What came up in Sabbath school today was the framing of the adversary's charges against God as being the original substitution of the truth about God, and all the garbage that has followed that, including the rebellion in heaven and then the loss of Earth's harmony, and how everything about the incarnation was to set that record straight for those who will accept the new or the resubstitution about the substituting the truth for the lie. I guess
yes.
Short. And I see that playing out here in Revelation.
You know, this wiping away tears from their eyes. You know, a number of years ago, one of the contemporary Christian songs irked me no end and still does when I hear it, when it says, I know that in heaven you're not supposed to cry, but I'm like, that is a complete reversal and twisting and abusing of what this is about. It does not say, hey, you're not supposed to cry. It says, you are going to be crying. And he's going to be wiping away the tears, which means you are crying. It's the exact opposite of that.
Yeah. And what it comforts me is that at the end of the millennium, after the wicked are gone, he wipes away the tears, because that's when they're going to flow the most.
And
that's the one aspect about eternity that I don't look forward to, but I know it has to be.
Well, there's no way through. It doesn't seem, the way things unfolded, it seemed inevitable that there would be pain and suffering, because rebellion against God is simply that.
Well, it's death. It's like embracing death instead of life.
Yeah.
And so there's going to be death at the end of the millennium.
And there'll be an experienced loss of that. I mean, for those who aren't lost, the feeling of that loss is strong.
Oh, yeah. And who knows how much interaction there will be before the advance is made against the city.
Yeah, the Bible's a little short on that gap of time.
Well, I personally believe, I conjectured at first, and somebody said that it's actually biblical, it's in Isaiah 65, that time is identified as 100 years.
And compared to eternity, that's very short, but compared to Earth and the sinful realm, it's very long.
And in my thinking, I believe the 1,000-year millennium, one of the main reasons for that period of time is that all who are saved need 1,000 years to grow up into the full reflection of God's character.
And
I believe the 100 years after the millennium, and this is actually, I think the millennium is to prepare them for what happens after the millennium.
Yes, I was
to mature them, because after the millennium, all the lost are resurrected and they are given time to fully mature their characters into the image of the beast or the dragon. And it only takes 100 years to finish that, which tells you that we're far closer to the image of the dragon starting out than we were to the image of God.
That's right. Well, I've always seen the millennium, as a time to grow up and as a time to understand why some weren't there. You know, I've known some very fine people who were racist. They were culturally raised that way. I remember one friend who I valued his friendship. I valued what he gave to me because he kind of mentored me. He had the exact opposite temperament of mine. So I valued his counsel because I wouldn't have seen it that way. And one day we were talking about something, I don't remember what, and he said that I mentioned that I thought, this is what I said. I said, I thought that it would be justice if everybody who despised blacks were black in heaven, you know, faced with black skin, so they could experience what it was like to be black. I was being only a little bit tongue in cheek on that, but he said, "Oh, my aunt had that all worked out. Everybody's going to be white in heaven." Mm. I was like, "Oh, come on."
That actually comes from a quote.
Of Ellen White?
Yes. You weren't aware of that?
No.
I'll have to send you a copy of it.
Wow.
I would think
What she said, and it's highly provocative if you're not open-minded. And I've looked at it closely. I don't have a problem with it. She says, there will be no color line in heaven. All will be white like Christ. Well,
but Christ isn't white.
Is not, that's right. But what she's saying is this artificial pigment distinction will not exist in heaven.
Yeah. I would think we would be, it's all like Middle Eastern, right?
Well, this is, yeah, you know.
Actually, I already do, so there's not much to change except a little darkening of my skin.
You guys are really shining the light on me right now. I'm about, my skin is a little olive or drab, you might say. Yeah, that pigmentation, yeah, that's something growing up in Chicago that you really have to put behind you for sure. And that blue eyes, you know, the curly hair and that white Jesus is kind of difficult for me because I first started walking with what they call Hebrew Israelites, which were much, much darker skin than I in Chicago. So I find it interesting that there might be that kind of a quote.
I look at all of the lines of demarcation that we give each other, whether it's race, gender, political affiliations, you know, ad nauseum, even religion, right? So did Christ die to reconcile the entire universe? Yes. The entire world? Yes. Everyone in it. And the Spirit goes out to convict. And I think there's beauty in being Christian, beauty in the declaration and growth of a Christian and an understanding of that story. To me, the millennium not only is a chance for us to individually mature, but to understand how big and inclusive.
Exactly.
That God really is. Exactly. And we were so limiting. Yes. I can't imagine anyone not being stretched by the inclusionary mind of God.
You will be very, very stretched. I mean, I don't relate very well to Samson, but he's going to be there.
Yeah, that's the record. Isaiah and Manasseh, you know.
Yeah.
There's so much. And then the biblical record even says how, you know, implies that God slayed whatever, a lot of people, including all those in the flood. And to find that maybe they're not all lost, except that they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that there's so much more to the story than we gave God room for. I'm not willing to close the door on anyone in any of the stories unless it was completely individual, because we don't have the whole record. We don't know everything that happened. And that, to me, is why the millennium is going to be so fascinating.
Yes.
We have stories that need, we have questions to stories that need answering.
I like that thought that you presented, Gene, also about, like you said, you know, being there and having I use the word A-track, but, you know, they break quite often. But being able to be there and have that ability to say, look, I messed up here, you know, and to have him say, okay, let's take a look at it. Let's see where. Perhaps you got off the path, you know, and realize how often I get thrown down rabbit holes, you know, and have that ability to not have that fear of judgment. And even the smallest of detail, you know, even the minutest, if it bothers me or if I'm feeling shame for it. And I guess you're going back, Floyd, to that, did you say Isaiah 65, where the children would be 100 years old?
Yeah.
Is that where you're pulling that from?
Yeah.
Hmm. Interesting.
I've looked at it. It satisfies me personally. It's not a theological argument point, but it has enough credibility to. And I actually came up with that number before I ever saw that. I just did it out of pure speculation of just like, okay, well, about how long would it take to do this and accomplish that? And all the dots get put back together, et cetera, et cetera. And I just said, you know, I think it'd be about 100 years. And I said that in a meeting and somebody came up to me afterwards and they said, you're right. I said, what? And they said, yeah, it's right there in the Bible. I think you're kidding. And so then I went and looked at it very carefully in context, look at the symbolism, all that stuff. And I said, you know what? It fits. I wanted to say one more thing about the wiping tears from her eyes, you know, which sounds and should sound very affectionate and comforting. But George Graves has a real passion for trying to get people to realize that God has emotions far yes. more than we do, and that he will never throughout eternity forget all the ones who chose death instead of living in his embrace of love. And he says, who is going to wipe the tears from his eyes?
That's exactly a good question.
And if we're allowed to, what an amazing privilege. I mean, you know, he spends 1,000 years comforting us, healing us, wiping the tears away. Then do we all get to participate in wiping his tears away as one by one the lost choose death instead of life? I mean, that's going to be trauma.
And can you imagine doing that with God when it comes to your loved one that you lost? Mm-hmm. And he's crying and you're crying and you wipe each other's tears.
And that's a very bonding experience.
The bonding that will take place is incredible. Just incredible bonding.
It makes you wonder. It gives a definition to tribulation for sure. In the time frame, from my standpoint, coming out of that great tribulation, going into that kind of a heartthrob, I don't know. That would be tough.
Yeah, debriefing is a very crude. You know, it's very shallow compared to the deep emotional debriefing where both sides become transparent and honest about how this is affecting them. And so they're sharing, I mean, to share with God his grief, because his grief is the actual definition of what got turned into what we call anger and wrath, but it's actually grief.
I had the unique privilege of, after my conversion experience, of learning how to read the Bible. I think I've mentioned this before, but I haven't mentioned this part of the story. I read the Old Testament through God's eyes, and I heard his tears at various places in the Bible where normally you think of anger or a very loud voice or something. And I began to get emotionally moved to the point where I'd have to quit reading. When I got to maybe Hosea 11, or something like that. And then I began to get there sooner and sooner and sooner, until practically in Genesis I was getting there. And I wouldn't quit reading for long, but, you know, I would have to quit reading for the time, because I was so overwhelmed by God's emotion. And I began to carry his emotion, his sorrow of loss in my person. I just carried it around like a burden, and I was happy to bear it, but it took its toll. And one day when I was teaching in Hong Kong, I came to the realization, you know, I want to live for him. I don't want to die for him if I can avoid it. So I decided I would have to let God be God and carry his own sorrow, and I would carry mine. But that emotion is still there. It's still locked in my brain. It's like God just put it on hold in some area of my brain, so I wasn't accessing it. And once in a while, something triggers it, and it's just like, oh, I'm overwhelmed. I can't take the mm-hmm. pain is enormous. So when you look at Jesus on the cross, who was bearing it all, he did it vicariously. And this is why I like the term vicarious. He was vicariously in empathy, experiencing it all. And it's why he died. That's God. on the cross, bearing it all. Ellen White calls it just a taste of what we see in the cross is just a taste of the enormous suffering God has experienced since sin's inception. And it just boggles my mind. And if I can do one little thing for God to soften that suffering, to heal that suffering, it would mean so much to me.
I would throw out a suggestion that we tackle the seventh seal next week, because that could go for quite a while.
Yeah. Yep. Well, we certainly have milked Revelation 7 for all it's worth.
for where we are currently, we probably can get more out of it eventually. So,
I know.
Yeah.
I think it was well worth the milk, so to speak.
Solid food.
Well, for me.
Gene had a beautiful summary, so that was a mic drop moment right there.
Well, it's a journey I have never shared before with anyone. it's kind of...
Did you read, what was his name that played Jesus?
Bruce Marciano.
I read his book. It was so powerful and an experience that he had.
Was he the one that played Jesus in that Jesus film?
The Matthew.
Where he almost died on the cross and he's been permanently injured from it?
I don't remember that.
Oh, no. Okay. That must have been somebody else who played Jesus.
The one I remember is how he, I think he's written on the whole experience, but the portion I remember is the woes to the Pharisees.
Yes, that was powerful.
Oh, because, that one. That's one. Oh, I love that one.
Yeah. It's the best. It was my introduction to how God in Jesus loved those who were against him.
Yeah.
Yes.
And when he told that part of it, that was a major turning point for him. And it became a major turning point for me and how I viewed.
When I saw that, I've showed that to students in my classes when I used to teach Life and Teachings of Jesus. That has meant so much to me because he's so encapsulated what I've always thought was in that text. Mm-hmm. And no, I never dreamed an actor would do that in this world.
Well, another story that was very parallel to that, that really impressed me. He said that he began praying, and it may have been around the time or maybe just before the woes when they filmed that. But he took very seriously. He wanted to get into the heart and mind of Jesus as much as God could get him there. And he began praying, I mean, really praying earnestly every day that God would allow him to see humans the way God sees them. So he was sitting one day on this low stone wall, and they were in, where is it, Morocco or someplace, some Muslim country, for the context. And he was praying, and all of a sudden it happened. And there were some cameramen, there was like between shots, and there were some cameramen not too far away. And they looked at him and they saw what was happening. They could see it on his face, and they whirled around and started shooting. Mm. But they weren't in focus. So they couldn't use it. But he said, just for like a second or two, it was like he saw humanity and all the sins, all the condemnation and guilt that Jesus felt. And he said, it almost killed him. And it was just, so emotionally overwhelming, and it had to be lifted almost immediately. But obviously, it completely changed his paradigm, his whole perspective of how God sees us, literally bearing all this and yet loving unconditionally all that while. And it just radically deepened his appreciation and affected his acting.
What is his last name?
Marciano.
So how do you spell that?
M-A-R-C-H-I-A-N-O.
I'm sorry, M-A-R-T-H?
C-H.
Oh, C-H. M-A-R-C-H-I.
I'll text it in here.
Thank you.
Not too long after I read his book, he came to our church in Berrien Springs. And I was on the soundboard, and he came up, you know, to the balcony where I was to talk to me about the microphone. And I had been praying that I could meet him in person. I mean, after reading the book, I'm like, man, I'd like to meet this guy. I'd like to experience just whatever would happen. And he came up there and we just talked, I don't know, for a minute or two. And all I can say is it affected me. I mean, obviously he's not God, but it was clear to me that he had been affected. And his spirit was so clean. I mean, just it wasn't what any image I had, especially of actors who had ever played Jesus, I wouldn't be that interested in meeting them. But after reading his book and seeing his radically different portrayal of Jesus, which is now, I think, being done again in The Chosen. But it shone. It affects people around him.
In a way, he changed something permanently in history.
Yeah, it did.
Because you realize The Chosen probably wouldn't have happened if he hadn't paved the way.
I was just reading the wiki page. He's played Jesus at least 12 different productions.
Wow.
And one company says from their tally, he's the one actor who's played Jesus the most times. His first time playing Jesus was the visual Bible, Matthew.
I don't know which one it was when he did the woes. So excellent.
Oh, that was the Matthew ones. Yeah.
If you read his story about one of the Pharisees who were on the set at that time, that really was powerful. Because, you know, he said that when he went through that scene, he completely blanked out. He doesn't remember anything, that entire scene. Even though he rehearsed it perfectly, executed it perfectly, he has no recollection whatsoever of anything that happened. He said when he woke up, he was in a hump off the set, weeping. And everybody's gathering around and go like, what happened? And he didn't know what had happened until he watched the video. But a couple years later, he was touring South Africa, promoting, you know, the movie and speaking in churches. And so he was in this church, you know, telling his story. And a man stood up in the church and walked up to the front and introduced himself. He was one of the Pharisees. He was an actor on the set.
Oh my.
Part of that scene. This actor was an atheist. He was a jerk. Nobody liked him, but he was such a good actor, they couldn't get rid of him. He was an excellent actor, probably a really good Pharisee, you know. But, you know, offset, he was offensive, he was rude, and nothing touched him. You know, it was like an oxymoron. This man walked up and he said, let me tell you the rest of the story. He said, when you did that on the set, and you said all those woes with tears streaming down your cheeks. He said, we weren't acting. This was real. And you were talking directly to my heart. And he was converted because of that scene on the set. And Bruce had never known about it until this man came up and shared that story with him 2 years later.
Is that story in the book?
I'm pretty sure, because I don't remember hearing anything else outside the book.
Well, that scene, I just loved the way he did that.
And he didn't even know what he was doing while he did it.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's something to ask God. What was happening?
There was no retakes on that scene.
Well, they couldn't do it better, you know.
Yeah, and he just said it's like the spirit took over, took complete control of his body, mm-hmm. until it was completely done, and he was oblivious to what had just happened. He had to go back and watch the tape to even know what he had done.
You know, that's when the human steps aside and says, God cast the glory. Well, shall we have closing prayer?
Sure.
Father in heaven, we have found morsels to chew on, as it were, from your word. And they have been rich and we have been blessed. Thank you for being the God you are. Thank you that we can love you with all our hearts and mind and soul and strength. Because you are worthy. Not because we're made to love you, not because we have to love you, but because you are so lovable. We thank you for this in Jesus' name. Amen.